Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast.
Showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change with Phoebe Scott,
Alex Miller,
Lottie Flashkus,
and Guy Wilkinson.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of IB Green Minds. I'm Lottie, your host of this episode, and joining me today is Gabby Herculano, CEO and co-founder at iClimate Earth. Welcome to the podcast, Gabby.
Thank you so much for having me, Lottie. I'm delighted to be here.
So to get started, could you explain what iClimate Earth is and what do you do?
Sure. We are a London-based green fintech. We wanted to redefine climate change investments. We like to paraphrase Simon Sinek in the States and refer to our why as decarbonization. We have that laser focus. We really want to look at the companies that can decarbonize the planet. And our what are exchange-traded funds, ETFs. For a variety of reasons, ETFs are a very exciting product. They are very democratic. They are very accessible to many different pockets of capital, from very small retail investors to very large institutional investors. They're very liquid. They are inexpensive. And they have become a very robust product. We are very close to $8 trillion of assets under management across the planet in terms of exchange-traded funds. And we felt that there was a market void, specifically in terms of ETFs that have that carbon focus. Most and foremost, we're looking at two kind of buckets. The low carbon ETFs that are very broad, 1,500 constituents. Generally, you have Microsoft, Google, and Amazon as the top companies. And these are the companies that we think are doing less harm. Most and foremost, they are reducing their carbon footprint, what is called scope 2, indirect emissions from renewable energy sources, which is the low-hanging fruit, applaudable. They're good corporate citizens. They're doing the right thing. They're decarbonizing. But decarbonization for these companies is a cost item. Right. So it's very much like managing your energy procurement sources. Right. Applaudable makes a lot of sense, but there is a limit to the impact that will come out of that. We don't think it's right to call these companies the climate champions, the companies that are decarbonizing the planet. We wanted to shift that narrative. We wanted to look at the companies where the revenue is in line with change. And we think that that is a profound distinction. So you have those very broad, low carbon, doing less harm type of ETFs. And then you have the very narrow focused, the usually clean energy ETFs, sometimes as low as 25 names. And usually it's just renewable energy. Renewable energy, we think, is part of that story, is not the bulk of the story. So we wanted to bring to market a new concept, the idea of a broad set of solutions that could decarbonize the planet. And we were very profoundly influenced by the findings of Project Drawdown. So Paul Hawken, the American environmentalist, he led a team of over 150 scholars between 2014 and 2017. And they looked at the 100 existing technologies that could be scaled up to bring the planet to that carbon neutrality by 2050. And they quantified that roadmap. And we thought that that was incredible. That was very relevant, right? Being able to quantify and put together that map, that puzzle, right, of how all the things will evolve in a metric, a very clear metric. So we wanted to bring this to a granular level. So what we did is we triangulated those findings with the list of EU taxonomy, of what EU taxonomy thinks would be green revenues, right? So the products and services that are deemed to be green. And then we triangulated that with Mission Innovation Potential Avoided Emissions Framework. Dennis Pamling, whom we've had the privilege of speaking to quite a few times, developed this concept, right, of how we quantify potential avoided emissions. So that is our key tangible metric. And we thought that it was about time that we would have a product very visible, like an ETF, that would have a very clear purpose, right? We're about the companies that can decarbonize the planet and a very key metric. So a tangible way to calculate impact, which for us is potential avoided emissions in gigatons of CO2 equivalent avoided per year, right? So we have a way to compare what these companies are doing and the relevance of their solutions. What we estimate is about 4.26 gigatons of CO2 equivalent that we need to avoid in 2021, right? Is that 7.6% of annual reductions in our 56 gigatons of emissions per year until 2030. So we cut our emissions by half, which is a very, very clear metric needed, but not an easy thing to do. So that's what we do, and that's what we think is unique. And we launched our first ETF at the London Stock Exchange in December last year. We were the most successful story of Honey ETF, who is our ETF issuer. And we hope to be bringing that story to the US as well.
Thanks for that introduction to iClimate Earth. For any listeners who are unfamiliar with ETFs, could you elaborate on what they are and how you make them? And also, you mentioned that you focus a lot on clean energy. What about if there is a large company that's not particularly green overall, but a subsidiary is working on a clean technology, such as direct air capture? Would they be eligible for inclusion or not?
Yeah, so that's a very good point. And I think there are two points that I would like to make. We not only look for the companies with green revenue and with that potential avoided emission metric, but we also negatively screen. So there are companies that are very much incumbent players from the fossil fuel industry that are looking and making investments and have some relevant solutions in the low carbon economy, but we negatively screen. So we don't want contamination. We want the companies that we think are most and foremost in line with change, not the companies that are most and foremost in line with business as usual, fossil fuel based. So my previous employer, GE, we negatively screen. So the company has very relevant solutions in terms of wind turbines, right? But they also produce diesel locomotives and they produce the engines for, so we refer to that as a fossil fuel association, the engines for the airplanes, which is, of course, jet fuel, which is fossil fuel. And then they still have a very big business in the supplying products and services for the oil and gas. So you put all of this together and that level of materiality with the business as usual, the fossil fuel industry, we deem that to be too high. So their green revenue solution is relevant, but it's quite contaminated. So we negatively screen to give that example. So on the carbon capture and sequestration, there seems to be a big correlation, right? With fossil fuel companies being the ones investing towards the solution. What we have, and we're very much motivated by this concept. We think the best way to reduce carbon in the atmosphere is by not emitting in the first place, right? So this is not a path towards a license to keep emitting and sequestration and carbon capture, which will keep us in the business as usual, right? We want to make that distinction. There are a lot of products and services that allow us to move away from that business as usual, right? Telepresence, plant-based burgers, a variety of solutions in the energy efficiency. So we until we move away and have transition, we're doing less harm, right? So smart meters, smart thermostats, things that allow us to be more efficient. Then ways for us to decarbonize transportation and heating, right? So heat pumps, and of course, electric vehicles, but electric vehicles to the power, like vehicles to grid, and all very exciting technologies that are coupling and converging. So that distinction, I think it's also very important for us to make. It's not about let's continue to emit and find a way to reduce this. It is the very much the opposite of that, is the concept of avoiding in the first place, not emitting in the first place. So fundamentally changing the way we live our lives and the way we do businesses, right? And we refer to this as a bit dramatic, but we like to refer to this as a seismic shift. Seismic because it's profound, right? We're going to divide our economies between those that are business as usual, fossil fuel based, and in line with the new economy, low emission or even zero emission. And that distinction is, I think it was not very well done. So what is an exchange traded fund? An exchange traded fund is a wrapper. So you put together a fund structure around a portfolio. And this industry has boomed. Basically, the CEO of Vanguard, who passed away a few years ago, he had this insight that there were a lot of, he believed in the beauty and the strength of the what's called passive indexing. The idea that it is very hard for you to outperform the market. So why not just hold the market? Right. And then he created these portfolios of wrappers. Right. So it's a very inexpensive way for you to own a benchmark. So you own a whole index. Right. So you can have S&P 500, FTSE 100, Dow Jones. That's like the biggest markets. But then you can have, you know, like exposure to Vietnam. You want to have the Vietnamese market, right? Or you can have, and then the whole industry started to evolve and become more sophisticated and to segment. And now we have these thematic ETFs, of which we are a part of, that tend to represent a very specific investment thesis, right? So 5G, Internet of Things, of course, decarbonization, cannabis, or emerging market retail, right? So you have a lot of products that put together these wrappers, right, which are the funds in itself, and you list them as if they were a company. So you can buy and sell these positions that follow a benchmark, which is more inexpensive. So you don't have, the investors don't underwrite our ability to stock pick and allocate across the portfolio, right? So that's called active portfolio management. We are the traditional passive ETF. So you will underwrite the theme and the methodology and then the constituents of the company, and you buy that portfolio, right? So usually in our case, the investors tend to have a longer term horizon. They like the theme for a variety of reasons, right? We see that tailwind coming from different directions, Paris Agreement, a global legislation across many countries, but we also have fiscal stimulus, right, in Norway, in China, really boosting electric vehicle adoption, for example, Biden with the Green New Deal in the States, right? So we put all of this together, and also the consumer shift, right? Nobody's telling us to become vegan or legislation forcing us to do that, or carpooling, right, which is a solution according to Drawdown. Uber and Lyft epitomize that idea, right? Four people in a car, not quite now with COVID, right? But that idea that otherwise those, you know, we would have had four cars driving around, and most likely they would all be internal combustion engine cars. So it's more sustainable to have carpooling and change that concept of car ownership. So that is a way for you to own that theme, right? And you like the idea of the selected names, and you want to hold that portfolio. And it's cheaper and easier than to buy all the underlying constituents, which of course any investor can also do. And I think that's, for all of these reasons, that's why we see this exchange traded fund industry growing so much.
As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, you're, of course, a co-founder of iClimate Earth. What career experience did you have before iClimate Earth, and why did you decide to establish the company?
My background is investment management, but I was on the private equity side, right? So this is listed security, this is public equity. So I was in the private equity. I went to business school in the States. I went to Wharton, majoring in finance. The three co-founders, we all went to Wharton. That's one of our common denominators. And my experience was very much in underwriting investments, predominantly in renewable energy. So I love the space. I love the idea. Well, I started working in energy, honestly speaking, in the 90s. I mean, my mid-40s. I worked at Lehman Brothers in New York. Then I went to business school. Then I went to the buy side, joined GE Capital, and was doing private equity investments there. So it's the analytical skills to underwrite an investment, right? What is the technology? What is the tariff? How are we going to get paid? What is the power purchase agreement like? or are we going to go merchant and sell to the grid? What is going to be that that tariff, you know, in case of a merchant? How much leverage can we do? What is, how do we finance this construction? How long is this going to take? What is the risk during construction? Is this fully permitted? Do we have all the licenses to then operate? What is the operating contract like? What is the insurance like? What are the key risks? Can we mitigate most of these risks? And then you try to summarize all of this in this very robust and detailed discounted cash flow models. And in infrastructure, where things tend to be a bit more stable and quite quantifiable, right? You have usually your revenues is price times tariff, right? And then you can model that. You know, you have, you do a solar study or you do a wind report, and you have the probability of how often the sun will shine, you know, in different ranges, and how the speed of the wind in different seasons. And then you have all of that model for the useful life of the equipment, which is usually 25 years. And then you have this very long, robust discounted cash flows. So that, I think that that is the passion for renewable energy, this qualitative approach to quantifying things, and then this idea of risk, right? Of identifying the risks and quantifying them and managing them. I think it's something that me and my COO, we worked together at G Capital actually, and we both went to Wharton and we're very good friends. We share this background, and it's something that I think it permeates our approach to the research that we have done, and the way that we look at the industries and the technologies. So we think that that's very relevant, right? This very analytical skill, very much based on data and in information. And then we just felt like we wanted to look at climate change more broadly beyond renewable energy. And we kept digging and doing research, and we just kept thinking, you know, people are not looking at the issues in the right way. And we just felt so compelled to shift the narrative or attempt to do that and tell the story in a different way and look at this comprehensive set of solutions that are directly reducing emissions, and make that distinction, which is, we think, is profound between the revenue being in line with decarbonization and then a cost being in line with decarbonization.
Digging a little bit more into what iClimate does, could you elaborate on the criteria you use to assess decarbonisation potential? You talked earlier a bit about how important you think it is to quantify the avoided emissions, and that being the key metric that you focus on.
Yeah, so the concept, so we start very much with this big picture, right? What are the products and services that can decarbonize the planet? And then we look at the different companies that fit in within that criteria. Then we look at their green revenue and how material is the revenue, right? And that is in percentage terms, so the green revenue vis-a-vis the total revenue. Then we look at the brown revenue to see if there is contamination, right? So we can negatively screen. And that's when a company, we're happy and we think that this company merits being part of our universe, right, of the climate champions. Then we want to quantify their impact, which is potential avoided emissions. So potential avoided emissions is a metric, right? It's a tangible metric. There are some assumptions that you need to make to be able to quantify that. So you set, first thing you do is you set the boundary, right? What is the business as usual? For Tesla is pretty obvious, right? Tesla is 91% of its revenue is related to electric vehicles. About 9% is related to energy. We think Tesla has the potential to be one of the biggest new energy companies on the planet. But as of now, they're being seen as an electric vehicle company. But there's so much more than that. But in any event, 91% of that revenue is electric vehicles, right? So business as usual is internal combustion engine. So that is the emissions per mile of a internal combustion engine car. And then the electric vehicle would allow you to run the same, you know, average 25 miles if you're commuting in the US, right? So you do those 25 miles instead of emitting by burning the fossil fuel in an internal combustion engine car, you are driving around an electric car. So then the embedded emission of that solution is the grid. So an electric vehicle is as clean as the grid. So an electric vehicle in China has much more embedded emissions than an electric vehicle in a grid, let's say in Norway, right? That is already materially installed capacity coming from renewable energy. So we need to look at that, where the electric vehicles are, so we can make that distinction. And then that delta is the difference, is the potential avoided emissions per unit. Then we have to extrapolate for the net number of cars sold in a year, right? So last year, Tesla sold very close to half a million electric vehicles. So you need to make that distinction in terms of where the cars are for the grid. And then you extrapolate the avoided emissions of one car vis-a-vis the alternative, which is a combustion engine. And you extrapolate that for the number of units, right? So it's tied to the revenue. So we've done this across our 28 subsectors. A lot of work. It's been well over a year doing all of that, because we have different solutions, right? Like plant-based burgers, right? So the Beyond Meat burgers versus the beef burger. So it's capturing that delta. It's capturing the you're having the nutritious content and you're satisfying your hunger, but you have a much lower carbon footprint. So we wanted to measure that. We wanted to identify the solutions. Of course, renewable energy is an obvious one, right? So that is, if you were not building an offshore wind, an onshore wind, or a solar park, right, you would have developed a fossil fuel, a coal fire power plant or a natural gas fire plant. Then we have the emissions for the different fuels. So the assumption is that the renewable energies are replacing and displacing the fossil fuel. So that delta is your potential avoided emissions.
There's been a proliferation of ESG products in recent years. However, there have also been criticisms. For example, a couple of weeks ago, a former chief investment officer of sustainable investment at BlackRock was pretty critical of ESG investing and described it as more risk management rather than actually helping to facilitate the low carbon transition. Do you think that there is widespread greenwashing by financial firms? And what do you think could be done about it?
Yes, we think there is widespread greenwashing in across everything. And the idea of this ESG, I think there's a lot of merit. There's a lot of people doing great work, very thorough work on attempting to quantify environmental metrics, social metrics, governance metrics, and it is applaudable for that effort. Now ESG became an acronym that is a household acronym, right, which is great. Now, the flip side of that is that we're talking about black boxes, right? So there's no consensus. There's no like credit ratings where you talk about how exactly you calculate the credit, and you have more clear metrics in terms of ranges of debt service coverage ratios and very observable metrics. And then there you derive the risk rating of a issuer, right? There's room for that to be improved. And there are a lot of products that are basically representing, oh, what are the companies with great ESG scores? And then you build portfolios based on that. It's like, okay, so you but what's the common denominator? What do these companies do, right? I mean, appreciate they get good scores, but British American Tobacco gets very good scores. They're still, right, selling tobacco. You want to buy tobacco, you buy a tobacco. But so you're trying to showcase that the way they go about producing that is quite sustainable. I mean, we need to talk about taxonomy in a very serious way. EU taxonomy is attempting to do that, which we think is great. And I think that the way to combat greenwashing is with data. It is, state your purpose, state your metrics. So let's be transparent about what the fund is trying to accomplish. If the fund is trying to accomplish, I'm trying to represent the companies that get very high rating according to a black box scorecard, well, state that, right? So that is very clear to investors that that's what it is. And what is your metric? Oh, my metric is, a high rate in according to a scorecard. Okay, great. You want to invest in that? Go for it, right? But you need to disclose that. So for us, it is our purpose is to represent the companies with products and services that are directly enabling decarbonization. And our metric is potential avoided emissions in gigatons of CO2 equivalent, right? So that's, I think it's something that I sure hope the whole industry will evolve towards that. And then let's look through, right? So you have, you know, how much AUM do you have, assets under management, and how much of that is associated with green, sustainable, and how much is that, you know, is associated with fossil fuel. So let's, you know, let's disclose that. Let's, I think journalists are doing a great job in pointing that out, right? Okay, so what kind of player you are? Are you yourself more associated with what side of the story, right? There's still a lot of capital connected to the energy business in terms of fossil fuel. So I think that is data. Data is the way for us to combat greenwashing.
And taking a step back, obviously, as an investment professional, you think a lot about how the future might unfold. How do you think our decarbonisation efforts might progress? And do you think there's anything that people, particularly investors, tend to misunderstand about the decarbonisation process?
I'm the glass half full kind of person. These technologies are converging and they're combining, they're coupling, right? So I'll give you an example, distributed generation, right? So the idea that you can generate electricity very close to the point of use. So solar rooftops epitomize this idea. Solar rooftops combined with battery storage. So the houses in California, or for the lucky Texans that already had that in their houses, right? 2 months ago when they went through that blizzard and they had power outages, weren't they happy that they had this installation at home, right? So this is at the bottom of what's called an S-shaped adoption curve. In the US, about 3% of the suitable homes that have that size of the rooftop with a good irradiation, only 3% of those houses have that solar rooftop installation. Now, because of the recent cost of reduction in cost of solar panels and battery solutions, and we're talking about incredible numbers. It's roughly about 90% drop of installation cost in the last 10 years, right? So we went from $2 per kilowatt hour to about 20 cents, right? That's material. So those solutions make economic sense. You save money when you embrace the solution, right? And then you start buying electric vehicle cars and the heat pumps, and your energy bill will increase materially from 40% to potentially 100%, depending on how many cars you have and how big is your house, right? So you will want to manage that electricity bill, right? In a very close way. Well, guess what? You can save money already from day one if you embrace this decarbonizing solution. So you would do this because it makes economic sense. So you put all of this together. This is very much in line with the Internet of Things and the 5G, right? Where our phones, our gadgets help us manage our lives. So Lottie arrives home with an electric vehicle car. Your phone will say, Lottie, not the time for you to charge your car now because this is peak hour. Do it later, right? Not the time for you to do a load of laundry. So you're going to demand manage in a way that we have never been able to do, because the houses of the future are here. We are at the bottom of this S-shaped curve. This is, we think, is going to boom. This is actually our second ETF is very much on that story of that distributed energy generation based on renewable energy solutions. We think that that is going to boom. And this is profound, right? So potentially 20% of all the electricity needs in the US will be produced by the users, residential, commercial, and industrial, right? And this is a very relevant decarbonization solution, and it makes economic sense. You save money and you hedge, right? Because the renewable energy is deflationary and fossil fuel is inflationary. That grid electricity continues to go up, right? There's not been a lot of investments in coal and natural gas, so those tariffs are expected to keep going up. So a residential user, a commercial user, an industrial user looks at the solar rooftop solutions combined with battery storage as a way to save money, and to mitigate that risk of security of supply and that risk of the electricity keep going up. So you put this together, you put electric vehicles together, the whole boom on the renewable energy, the solving intermittence again with potentially green hydrogen, right? And that's another very exciting trend that we follow. You put all of these solutions together and they combine and they make each other more relevant. So we think that the future is bright and things are changing so fast. So we do think that by 2030, this adoption of this, right, a lot of developed markets will not be selling internal combustion engines at all by 2030. Solar rooftop is going to be everywhere because it makes economic sense. Car will never be, you know, the way it was when I was a kid, right? We're going to have car as a service. It is beyond electric vehicles, it's beyond autonomous driving, it's computerized power plant on wheels, right? This is really powerful and profound in a very different way to manage, right, this asset that it's very underutilized, is usually just parking, right, outside. And then I'll leave you with a final thought. As I mentioned to you, we went to Wharton. We had a professor that wrote a very interesting book called 2030. So he makes some very exciting predictions. One of the things he predicts is that by 2030, half of the wealth on the planet will be in the hands of women. Because a variety of reasons, we're breaking the glass ceiling, more of us stay in the workforce after having kids, we tend to live longer. So there's a bit of an inheritance issue there, and we're becoming more entrepreneurs. More and more businesses are being started by female. You put all of this together, and by 2030, he predicts that half of the wealth on the planet will be in the hands of women. Women tend to manage investments in a different way. So it's very likely that that ESG focus and that sustainability, investing on things in a different way, investing on the things that really make sense, will just increase. And 2030, it's here, right? I mean, it's around the corner. So I think that the future is bright.
That's a very hopeful note. And I completely agree with what you're saying about the S-curve. By our nature, we think about things in a linear way. And it's very difficult to see that we're at the bottom of an S-curve that could very quickly, the situation could very quickly change. So I've just got a couple more questions for you. If a listener is interested in working in the green fintech space, what advice would you have for them?
Well, I think you need to think about three things, right? Geography, product, and industry. And I think it's very good to be very good at all of these, right? So there's an element of regulation, right? If you're talking water and waste, recycling, right? There's these industries, some of them are more regulated. So you need to, if you have a focus on a geography, think about that and take that into account. On the product side, right? Well, to understand electrolyzers and fossil fuels and solid batteries, lithium-ion batteries, gel batteries, right? It's a bit technical, right? Or even just you know, renewable energy. I've done solar, I've done wind, I've done offshore wind, right? They're different. You need to appreciate, you know, the complexities of operating and building them in more detail. So that's element number two. And element number three is a product. Are you looking at investment as equity? Are you thinking venture capital, early stage? Are you thinking more private equity? Are you thinking capital markets, listed companies, right? So think about that across the spectrum. Or are you thinking debt, right? You're excited about being, you know, providing debt structures for projects that mitigate climate change or adaptation, right? And what sorts of capital could that be, from a multilateral agency or a commercial bank? So I think that you have to think about these three things, right? Where your passion and your interests really are. Do you want to have an international career? You want to bounce around? I grew up in Brazil. I lived in the States for 10 years. I've been in Europe for many years. I lived in Singapore as well. So with that, I leverage an industry, right? Energy and finance and M&A and equity, right? So very equity and very energy. And I brought that across different geographies. I have a lot of friends that are in real estate, and I think sustainable real estate is such an exciting thing. I would put vertical farms into that category. Well, real estate is very local, right? You really need to understand every street and every, right? And the permitting process of every different council and region, right? So if that is your passion, right? So think very hard about where you want to be, because you may not be so movable, right? And transfer that knowledge across. And then think very hard about the technologies, right? I think subject matter is very relevant. And think about what really, you know, you're passionate about and what, you know, you really would like to focus on. And then think about it in a very systematic way about geography, about product, about industries, right? And then design your career accordingly. Just don't go with the flow. Drive it, right? Don't be happy. Try to be happy with what you end up with. Lead with your passion. Lead with your interest. And think about these things, I think, in a more systematic way.
And if listeners take away one thing from this episode of the IB Green Minds podcast, what would you want it to be?
I think I would like it to be that we need to be more precise about what we mean, right? So you care about decarbonization, ask questions. What do you mean by that? Are these companies where the revenue is in line? Are these companies where the decarbonization effort is a cost line item, right? Ask questions. When I speak to people in your age group, right? We've done some focus groups at the beginning, you know, right when we were incorporating, trying to understand how people felt about investing for climate change. And it's, you know, we get very passionate responses. I will only invest if it is, you know, a sustainable theme. That's the only thing that I care about. And that we thought that was so inspiring. And this new generation, you're very resourceful. You ask the right questions. So I think that's what I would very much like people to remember, right? Ask questions. If you're being offered a investment, or if you're looking at an investment opportunity, think about this. What is the purpose of this fund? What are they trying to represent? And what is their key metric?
That's all from us. Thank you very much, Gabby, for taking the time to appear on the Green Minds podcast. It's been really lovely to hear about your work and your perspective on decarbonisation and the future. So thank you very much.
Lottie, thank you so much.